Chapter 26. He supped alone, and at the appointed hour proceeded to the Duke's apartments, taking no farther precaution than to carry his passport about him. The palace seemed deserted. Everywhere an air of apprehension and mystery hung over the long corridors and dimly lit antechambers. The day had been sultry, with a low sky foreboding great heat, and not a breath of air entered at the windows. There were few persons about, but one or two beggars lurked as usual on the landings of the great staircase, and Odo, in passing, felt his sleeve touched by a woman cowering under the marble ramp in the shadow thrown by a colossal Caesar. Looking down, he heard a voice beg for alms, and as he gave it the woman pressed a paper into his hand, and slipped away through the darkness. Odo hastened until he could assure himself of being unobserved. Then he unfolded the paper, and read these words in Gamba's hand: colon, have no fear for anyone's safety but your own. With a sense of relief he hid the message, and entered the Duke's antechamber. Here he was received by a Legenstern's oriental servant, who, with a mute salutation, led him into a large room, where the Duke's pages usually waited. The walls of this apartment had been concealed under hangings of black silk worked with cabalistic devices. Oil lamps set on tripods of antique design shed a faint light over the company seated at one end of the room, among whom Odo recognized the chief dignitaries of the court. The ladies looked pale but curious, the men for the most part indifferent or disapproving. Intense quietness prevailed, broken only by the soft opening and closing of the door through which the guests were admitted. Presently the Duke and Duchess emerged from His Highness's closet. They were followed by Prince Ferrand, supported by his governor and his dwarf, and robed in a silken dressing gown which hung in voluminous folds about his little shrunken body. Their highnesses seated themselves in two armchairs in front of the court, and the little prince reclined beside his mother. No sooner had they taken their places than a Legenstern stepped forth, wearing a doctor's gown and a quaintly shaped bonnet or mitre. In his long robes and strange headdress he looked extraordinarily tall and pale, and his features had the glassy-eyed fixity of an ancient mask. He was followed by his two attendants, the Oriental carrying a framework of polished metal, not unlike a low narrow bed, which he set down in the middle of the room, while the Georgian lad, who had exchanged his fustanella and embroidered jacket for a flowing white robe, bore in his hands a crystal globe set in a gold stand. Having reverently placed it on a small table, the boy, at a signal from his master, drew forth a phial, and dropped its contents into a bronze vatter brazier which stood at the far end of the room. Instantly clouds of perfumed vapor filled the air, and as these dispersed it was seen that the black hangings of the walls had vanished with them, and the spectators found themselves seated in a kind of open temple through which the eye traveled down colonnaded vistas set with statues and fountains. This magical prospect was bathed in sunlight, and Odo observed that, though the lamps had gone out, the same brightness suffused the room, and illuminated the wondering faces of the audience. The little prince uttered a cry of delight, and the magician stepped forward, raising a long white wand in his hand. "This," said he, in measured accents, "is an evocation of the Temple of Health, into whose blissful precincts the wisdom of the ancients was able to lead the sufferer who put his trust in them. This deceptio vicis, or product of rhabdomancy, easily effected by an adept of the Egyptian mysteries, is designed but to prefigure the reality which awaits those who seek health through the ministry of the disciples of Iamblichus. It is no longer denied among men of learning that those who have been instructed in the secret doctrine of the ancients are able, by certain correspondences of nature, revealed only to the initiated, to act on the inanimate world about them, and on the animal economy, by means beyond the common capabilities of man." He paused a moment, and then, turning with a low bow to the Duke, inquired whether His Highness desired the rites to proceed. The Duke signed his assent, and a Legenstern, raising his wand, evoked another volume of mist. This time it was shot through with green flames, and as the wild light subsided, the room was once more revealed with its black hangings, and the lamps flickered into life again. After another pause, doubtless intended to increase the tension of the spectators, the magician bade his servant place the crystal before him. He then raised his hands, as if in prayer, speaking in a strange chanting jargon, in which Odo detected fragments of Greek and Latin, and the recurring names of the Judaic demons and angels. As this ceased, Hale-Jenstern beckoned to the Georgian boy, who approached him with bowed head and reverently folded hands. "Your Highness," said Hale-Jenstern, "and this distinguished company are doubtless familiar with the magic crystal of the ancients, in which the future may be deciphered by the pure in heart. This lad, whom I rescued from slavery, and have bred to my service in the solemn rites of the priesthood of Isis, is as clear in spirit as the crystal which stands before you. The future lies open to him in this translucent sphere, and he is prepared to disclose it at your bidding." There was a moment's silence, but on the magician's repeating his inquiry, the Duke said, "Colin, let the boy tell me what he sees." Hale-Jenstern at once laid his hands on his acolyte's head, and murmured a few words over him. Then the boy advanced and bent devoutly above the crystal. Almost immediately the globe was seen to cloud, as though suffused with milk. The cloud gradually faded and the boy began to speak in a low, hesitating tone. "I see," he said, "I see a face. A fair face." He faltered and glanced up almost apprehensively at Hale-Jenstern, whose gaze remained impenetrable. The boy began to tremble. "I see nothing," he said in a whisper. "There is one here purer than I. The crystal will not speak for me in that other's presence." "Who is that other?" Hale-Jenstern asked. The boy fixed his eyes on the little prince. An excited murmur ran through the company and Hale-Jenstern again advanced to the Duke. "Will your Highness," he asked, "permit the prince to look into the sacred sphere?" Odo saw the Duchess extend her hand impulsively toward the child, but at a signal from the Duke the little prince's chair was carried to the table on which the crystal stood. Instantly the former phenomenon was repeated, the globe clouding, and then clearing itself like a pool after rain. "Speak, my son," said the Duke. "Tell us what the heavenly powers reveal to you." The little prince continued to pore over the globe without speaking. Suddenly his thin face reddened, and he clung more closely to his companion's arm. "I see a beautiful place," he began, his small fluting voice rising like a bird's pipe in the stillness, "a place a thousand times more beautiful than this. Like a garden, full of golden-haired children, with beautiful strange toys in their hands. They have wings like birds. They are birds, ah. They are flying away from me, I see them no more. They vanish through the trees." He broke off sadly. Hale-Jenstern smiled. "That, your Highness, is a vision of the prince's own future, when, restored to health, he is able to disport himself with his playmates in the gardens of the palace." "But they were not the gardens of the palace," the little boy exclaimed. "They were much more beautiful than our gardens." Hale-Jenstern bowed. "They appeared so to your Highness," he deferentially suggested, "because all the world seems more beautiful to those who have regained their health." "Enough, my son," exclaimed the Duchess with a shaken voice. "Why will you weary the child?" she continued, turning to the Duke, and the latter, with evident reluctance, signed to Hale-Jenstern to cover the crystal. To the general surprise, however, Prince Ferent pushed back the black velvet covering which the Georgian boy was preparing to throw over it. No, he exclaimed, in the high obstinate voice of the spoiled child, "let me look again. Let me see some more beautiful things. I have never seen anything so beautiful, even in my sleep." It was the plaintive cry of the child whose happiest hours are those spent in unconsciousness. "Look again, then," said the Duke, "and ask the heavenly powers what more they have to show you." The boy gazed in silence, then he broke out, "Colin, now we are in the palace. I see your highness's cabinet. No, it is the bedchamber. It is night. And I see your highness lying asleep. Very still, very still. Your highness wears the scapula received last Easter from his holiness. It is very dark. Oh, now a light begins to shine. Where does it come from? Through the door? No, there is no door on that side of the room. It shines through the wall at the foot of the bed. Ah! I see his voice mounted to a cry, the old picture at the foot of the bed. The picture with the wicked people burning in it has opened like a door. The light is shining through it, and now a lady steps out from the wall behind the picture. Oh, so beautiful, she has yellow hair, as yellow as my mother's. But longer, oh, much longer, she carries a rose in her hand. And there are white doves flying about her shoulders. She is naked, quite naked, poor lady. But she does not seem to mind. She seems to be laughing about it, and your highness. The Duke started up violently. Enough, enough. He stammered. The fever is on the child. This agitation is most pernicious. Cover the crystal, I say. He sank back, his forehead damp with perspiration. In an instant the crystal had been removed, and Prince Farron carried back to his mother's side. The boy seemed in no wise affected by his father's commotion. His eyes burned with excitement, and he sat up eagerly, as though not to miss a detail of what was going forward. Maria Clementina leaned over and clasped his hand, but he hardly noticed her. I want to see some more beautiful things, he insisted. The Duke sat speechless, a fallen heap in his chair, and the courtiers looked at each other, their faces shifting spectrally in the faint light, like phantom travelers waiting to be ferried across some mysterious river. At length Heiligenstern advanced, and with every mark of deference addressed himself to the Duke. Your Highness, said he quietly, need be under no apprehension as to the effect produced upon the Prince. The magic crystal, as your Highness is aware, is under the protection of the blessed spirits, and its revelations cannot harm those who are pure-minded enough to receive them. But the chief purpose of this assemblage was to witness the communication of vital force to the Prince, by means of the electrical current. The crystal, by revealing its secrets to the Prince, has testified to his perfect purity of mind, and thus declared him to be in a peculiarly fit state to receive what may be designated as the sacrament of the new faith. A murmur ran through the room, but Heiligenstern continued without wavering colon I mean thereby, to describe that natural religion which, by instructing its adepts in the use of the hidden potencies of earth and air, testifies afresh to the power of the unseen maker of the universe. The murmur subsided, and the Duke, regaining his voice, said with an assumption of authority colon let the treatment begin. Heiligenstern immediately spoke a word to the Oriental, who bent over the metal bed which had been set up in the middle of the room. As he did, so the air again darkened and the figures of the magician and his assistants were discernible only as flitting shades in the obscurity. Suddenly a soft pure light overflowed the room, the perfume of flowers filled the air, and music seemed to steal out of the very walls. Heiligenstern whispered to the governor, and between them, they lifted the little prince from his chair, and laid him gently on the bed. The magician then leaned over the boy with a slow weaving motion of the hands. If your highness will be pleased to sleep, he said, I promise your highness the most beautiful dreams. The boy smiled back at him, and he continued to bend above the bed with flitting hands. Suddenly the little prince began to laugh. What does your highness feel? The magician asked. A prickling. Such a soft warm prickling, as if my blood were sunshine with motes dancing in it. Or, as if that sparkling wine of France were running all over my body. It is an agreeable sensation, your highness. The boy nodded. It is well with your highness? Very well. Heiligenstern began a loud rhythmic chant, and gradually the air darkened. but with the mild dimness of a summer twilight, through which sparks could be seen flickering like fireflies about the reclining prince. The hush grew deeper, but in the stillness Odo became aware of some unseen influence that seemed to envelope him in waves of exquisite sensation. It was as though the vast silence of the night had poured into the room, and, like a dark tepid sea, was lapping about his body and rising to his lips. His thoughts, dissolved into emotion, seemed to waver and float on the stillness like seaweed on the lift of the tide. He stood spellbound, lulled, yielding himself to a blissful dissolution. Suddenly he became aware that the hush was too intense, too complete. And a moment later, as though stretched to the cracking point, it burst terrifically into sound. A huge uproar shook the room, crashing through it like a tangible mass. The sparks whirled in a menacing dance round the little prince's body, and, abruptly blotted, left a deeper darkness, in which the confused hurting movements of startled figures were indistinguishably merged. A flash of silence followed. Then the liberated forces of the night broke in rain and thunder on the rocking walls of the room. "Light, light," someone stammered, and at the same moment a door was flung open, admitting a burst of candlelight, and a group of figures in ecclesiastical dress, against which the white gown and black hood of Father Ignazio detached themselves. The Dominican stepped toward the Duke. "Your Highness," said he in a tone of quiet resolution, "must pardon this interruption. I act at the bidding of the Holy Office." Even in that moment of profound disarray, the name sent a deeper shudder through his ears. The Duke, who stood grasping the arms of his chair, raised his head and tried to stare down the intruders. But no one heeded his look. At a signal from the Dominican, a servant had brought in a pair of candelabra, and in their commonplace light the cabalistic hangings, the magician's appliances and his fantastically dressed attendants looked as tawdry as the paraphernalia of a village quack. Heligenstern alone survived the test. Erect, at bay as it were, his black robe falling in hieratic folds, the white wand raised in his hands, he might have personified the Prince of Darkness drawn up undaunted against the hosts of the Lord. Someone had snatched the little prince from his stretcher, and Maria Clementina, holding him to her breast, sat palely confronting the sorcerer. She alone seemed to measure her strength against his in some mysterious conflict of the will. But meanwhile the Duke had regained his voice. "My father," said he, "on what information does the Holy Office act?" The Dominican drew a parchment from his breast. "Oh, on that of the Inquisitor General, Your Highness," he replied, handing the paper to the Duke, who unfolded it with trembling hands, but was plainly unable to master its contents. Father Ignazio beckoned to an ecclesiastic who had entered the room in his train. "This, Your Highness," said he, "is the Abate de Crucis of Innsbruck, who was lately commissioned by the Holy Office to inquire into the practices and doctrine of the Order of the Illuminati, that corrupt and..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.